late start today. We ran overtime on the floor session. Appreciate all of you being here today. We are going to change the order of our business slightly and begin with a hearing on House Bill 2770, and then we'll go back to the agenda and move through the remainder of the agenda. So with that, I will open a public hearing on House Bill 2770. And Mr. Taylor, I'm going to wait for you to get back to your chair to give us a brief overview.
Okay.
Chair, members of the committee, Senate House Bill 2770 comes to you from Representative Floyd Brzezinski and Representative Backlund. Creates a crime of strangulation and classifies the crime as a Class A misdemeanor, defines the crime of strangulation as knowingly impeding the normal breathing or circulation of the blood of another person by applying pressure on the throat or neck of the other person or blocking the nose and mouth of the other person. It exempts legitimate medical procedures or good faith practices or religious beliefs. Classifies strangulation as a Class C felony if the crime was committed in the immediate presence of witnesses by the person or victim's minor children, and sets forth other provisions where it makes it a Class C felony.
Okay, thank you. Representative Brzezinski, you were going to do a brief introduction for the committee. Is that right?
Yes, I'm wondering if I go ahead and sit here just for a moment, do a couple introductions and bring a couple people from the work group up, and then we can allow the testimony to begin.
Yeah, that would be fine. So is this...
Phyllis Barkhurst.
There's six people.
Okay.
All the one.
Why don't we just go ahead and let Representative Brzezinski, you go ahead and have a seat, Phyllis, and then we'll just bring them up. I've got a long list here, and we'll just work through in panels after that. Is that appropriate, Representative?
Mr. Chair, that's fine.
Okay.
For the record, Floyd Brzezinski, House District 8. I'm here just to do an introduction for Phyllis Barkhurst, who is one of the individuals who's been part of the work group that's been putting together the bill that's before us, House Bill 2770. This is a combination, and you'll hear from the testimony today, from numerous individuals and groups from around the state trying to bring forward and rectify and take care of an issue regarding domestic violence that has been a concern for many individuals, including myself as a prosecutor, to make certain that individuals are held accountable for this type of conduct. I do want to call to the committee's attention, there is a dash one that has been distributed, and there's just as of 5 minutes ago a letter that has been circulated as well that goes with the dash ones. And I just call that to your attention now because there will probably need to be a discussion as to whether or not the dash ones are necessary in their current state because of some of the concerns that have been raised by public safety officers. In fact, the city of Eugene had emailed me with a concern, but I believe once we look at the letter from Council Virginia Vanderbilt that we may want to have a little more open discussion if we get there today in a public in a work session. With that, I'll turn it over to Phyllis Barkhurst, who can give you the overview of where we're at and why the bill's here.
Thank you, Representative Brzezinski. I appreciate that. Before we start, Ms. Barkhurst, we've got a pretty full room today. There is overflow seating for anyone who doesn't want to have to stand up through this in room 343, which is the Senate Judiciary hearing room, just directly opposite in the other side of the center part of the building from us, and that has television coverage. So if anybody feels like they want to need to go there to watch, they're welcome to do that. Ms. Barkhurst, I've got Chris Karchner listed. Now, who did you want to bring up? Is that who you wanted to bring up?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Chris Karcher, Kim Timmius, Craig Roberts, Gina Skinner, Gene Kunkel, Miley Mikulski, and Lisa Fryer are all.
Okay, why don't we bring up, bring up the first four of them?
Okay.
How about we do that? So Chris Karchner, Kim Timmius, Craig Roberts. Let's start with that panel, how about? And then we can bring up Gene Kunkel and Gina Skinner in the second panel. Is that okay? Okay. Please begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Phyllis Barkhurst, and I am with the Attorney General's Sexual Assault Task Force, and I'm also a member of the Oregon Alliance to End Violence Against Women. I'm speaking today on House Bill 2770. Wanted to give the committee just a few minutes on how we got here. For the last year or year and a half, the Alliance, which is a public policy group relating to issues of domestic violence and sexual assault, has been going around the state asking people who work in the field to identify gaps in the system or ways the system may not be working, an issue that keeps coming up repeatedly from prosecutors' offices around the state, as well as law enforcement and advocates and survivors, is a need to better address the issue of and crime of strangulation, that what we have in place now does not do so. And other members of our group are going to talk more about the specifics of the bill, why the strategy we feel will help fix that. So we formed a multidisciplinary work group with people from the ODAA, as well as law enforcement officers. Forensic medical experts, advocates, and survivors have been meeting for 6 months and drafted the bill from that work group. And I'd like to now turn this over to Chris Karcher.
Hi, thank you. My name is Chris Karcher. I am the chief deputy medical examiner and a forensic nurse examiner down in Coos County. So I have, through both those roles, am very intimate with victims of violence, which has given me the opportunity to see strangulation and the effects of strangulation. It's very important to me and very passionate to me that everyone understand that strangulation is so terribly dangerous and life-threatening. Just quickly to overview again what the definition of strangulation is. Strangulation is the act of asphyxiation, and you become asphyxiated by two methods. One is to inhibit the blood flow to and from the brain, and the other is to obstruct your airway, not allowing air to the brain or oxygen to the brain as well. Just to refresh the anatomy of the neck a little bit, and maybe that would be a little helpful. Your airway or your trachea has a little something in it called the voice box or the larynx. The larynx has a couple of cartilage rings that protect it, keep it open so that we can breathe through it. It's a delicate structure. Above the larynx is a horseshoe-shaped bone that kind of stabilizes the base of the tongue, keeps the tongue from falling into your airway. It is, again, very delicate, and both of these structures are very easily injured. On the outside of the neck, you have the carotid artery on both sides. It carries oxygenated blood to the brain. Next to those are the jugular veins that carry deoxygenated blood back out of the brain. You can obstruct those, leading to unconsciousness. It takes about 11 pounds placed, external pressure placed on either the carotids or the jugulars, and you can render someone unconscious in about 10 seconds. The airway, if you can obstruct the airway with approximately three times that amount of external pressure, about 33 pounds on the external, external pressure, on the larynx to obstruct the airway. To give you some sort of a comparison, if you took a young, healthy male, say between the ages of 20 and 30, the grip and the force of the grip of his, the pounds, if you could measure his grip, is in his dominant hand would be about 120 pounds. In his non-dominant hand, it would be about 110 pounds. You can also measure the pressure between a thumb and index finger, just pinching. That same individual in his dominant hand would be about 26 pounds. In his non-dominant hand, between the index and thumb, would be about 25 pounds. So you can kind of compare what a normal, healthy young male's grip would be in comparison to the amount of force that it would need to occlude those delicate airways and circulatory system. The other thing that I think that we need to remember is that strangulation, unlike other violence such as just in comparison to a gunshot. A gunshot, the bullet leaves the gun. It's going to do some damage. We know that. We don't know exactly where it's going to hit, but we know what kind of damage it's going to leave. Strangulation, we don't know. It's on a continuum. One end of the continuum is touching someone's neck. The other end of the continuum is death. And it's just a matter of minutes between the two ends of that continuum. There are a number of effects of strangulation that fall into different levels of severity. Probably the most common and the easiest to describe would be pain that a victim is left with after a strangulation. And then there is hoarseness. They sometimes will even lose their voice. There is swelling in the throat. The swelling is caused from a number of things. It can be caused from hemorrhage in that area. It can be caused from damage or fractured larynx, the hyoid bone, that allow air to leak into those tissues, causing something called subcutaneous emphysema, which again will constrict the airway and limit the airway. There is damage or could be damage to the lungs from vomitus that is inhaled into the lungs. The gastric juices can damage the lung tissue very easily and very quickly, and it leads to something called aspiration pneumonia. It can, if a woman is pregnant, she can miscarry. There is an array of things that are effects of the strangulation. Some of these that I've mentioned could be immediate, short-lived. Some can be persistent, and some can be permanent. The physical evidence that a woman has been strangled is less observable sometimes. It's only visible in about 50% of the time, but that usually involves scratches, abrasions to the neck, usually in a defensive mode by the victim, but oftentimes in combination with the assailant and the victim. There is also another physical feature of strangulation that is sometimes seen, not always. It's called petechiae. It's the rupture of capillaries, usually around the eyes and in the eyes. But again, you don't always see that. So you don't always have physical evidence to relate to what the effects of the strangulation event to the victim might be. I'm going to give you an example of a case that I had. I had several cases, but I probably will just give you one. This was a 21-year-old victim who was strangled manually with both hands. She was rendered unconscious and left unconscious. She, when I visited with her, she said that she thought she was going to die, and she could not raise her arms to fight him off. And all the effects that she suffered. She had a miscarriage about a week after the incident. She also developed aspiration pneumonia because she aspirated vomitus into her lungs while she was unconscious. She was incontinent of stool, which also is a common effect during the event. They lose control of stool and urine. She, in following the incident, had... she had seizures on one side of her body. It was on the right side. What it was finally discovered through a lot of testing was that when his hands were big, she was small, there was damage to her nerves in the back of her neck, which rendered her arms useless. But it's left her with permanent disability. She no longer can use her right arm and right leg the way she used to. It's weak, and she has foot drop. She also is still hoarse. Her voice, some days she has her voice the way it was before the incident, some days she doesn't, but she survived. I guess what I would leave you with is the difficulty in strangulation is that it is on a continuum, and the differences between touch and death is just a few minutes, and it evolves when and how the pressure is released. Thank you.
Thank you. Why don't we go ahead and complete the panel, and then we'll have questions.
Mr. Chair, can I proceed? Hi, my name is Craig Roberts. I'm a detective with the Clackamas County Sheriff's Office and the program director of our DIVERT unit there, and that is a domestic violence enhanced response team. It's a unit that's comprised of various disciplines to have a community impact on domestic violence within Clackamas County. And I'm going to talk just shortly. I mean, I've been with the Sheriff's Office for over 20 years, and things that we have seen there within the Sheriff's Office, and as mentioned earlier, from the spectrum from minor injuries all the way to homicides as a result of strangulation. And I think when we take a look at the problem that we have in Clackamas County, I mean, we have over 3,000 calls to 911 in reference to domestic violence calls. We have about 1,500 police reports as a result of that. And one of the key things and problems that we see pertaining to the strangulation issue is it's really complex. It's to have our initial responding officers highly educated on this particular issue. And it becomes real complex for our initial patrol officers responding to make that assessment. Because as mentioned earlier, a lot of times there aren't any signs of injuries. And I can tell you that when patrol officers respond there, one of the first things they're going to do is to try and find out if there is any injuries. And a lot of times there are no outward signs of injuries. So that is a huge benefit in making that more clear for the frontline folks. I think that one, and I'm going to make this real short, but throughout my career, like I said, I've worked a lot of homicides and less than lethal cases regarding strangulation, and we have a lot of those cases. And one particular case really stands out in my mind. It was an individual that in 1991 murdered his wife. Based on my investigation, she has never been found. He's never been prosecuted. Since that event, he obtained another girlfriend, was strangling her just before she went unconscious. He made the statement that, "I'm going to do the same thing to you as I did to my first wife." And it is a pattern of behavior, and that we do see it a lot, and it is a huge issue for us in Clackamas County. So with that, that's just some personal experience that I'd like to relate, and I think that's it.
Good. Thank you very much, Mr. Roberts. Is it?
I'll just pass for
you. Okay, are you sure? All right,
sure.
Good. All right, then, panel or committee, let's open it up for questions of the panel. There are none. Okay. All right, that's fine. Phyllis, do you want to stay while we bring up the next panel, or are you done with your part of the presentation?
I'm done, unless there's any questions. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you very much. I appreciate
thank
all
you.
Of you coming down for this testimony. Next would be Jean Kunkel and Gina Skinner from ODAA. And since we've got four chairs, do you mind if I bring somebody else up, or you're bringing somebody else up with you, right?
This is Ms. Fryer also with us. She's a survivor, so she's going to speak after.
Ms. Fryer?
Yes.
Okay, good. So you're on the list as well. That's fine.
It's a gentleman of the committee, and there's no ladies up here today, apparently. My name is Gina Skinner, and I'm a deputy district attorney. I've been prosecuting primarily domestic violence cases now for many years. I started out in Marion County, and currently I'm prosecuting in Washington County, so I have a little bit of a experience on both two different places. Strangulation cases are extremely common and extremely difficult to prosecute. I think you've already heard some testimony about how deadly and dangerous that they can be to victims, but they're extremely frustrating to prosecutors. Currently, there's a large hole in where the law exists to be able to prosecute these cases. It's very inconsistent amongst individual DAs themselves, and especially between counties in the state and how these cases are handled. Primarily, the charges that are used now sometimes is a misdemeanor assault 4, which requires that we prove that the defendant caused physical injury to another person, physical injury being the impairment of physical condition or substantial pain. As you've just heard testimony, it's extremely difficult to prove that the person has actually been physically injured. When the police officers arrive at the scene, one of the first things they have to do is figure out if somebody, in fact, is injured, if a crime has been committed, and they have to determine who is the primary aggressor. And if the first thing that they're looking at is a person that does not appear to show an injury, then it might be unlikely that they would make an arrest. So in order to go forward with physical injury, we're going to have some kind of bruising or some kind of deep cuts or some kind of testimony from a victim that there is substantial pain. The other charges that are sometimes used are menacing, which is that, again, that the defendant intentionally attempted to place another person in fear of imminent serious physical injury, which is more than just the physical injury. Basically, it's having to show that there is a substantial risk of death, protracted disfigurement, a protracted impairment of their health or function or of their bodily organs. Again, that's a very difficult to prove. Also, attempted assault in the second degree, that they intentionally attempted to cause them serious physical injury, which is the definition that I just read to you. Those are the crimes that we have available to us currently. The other one is harassment, which is just an offensive contact. That's only a B misdemeanor. It's not a person's crime. It does not count on the sentencing guidelines grid for any future crimes, and it is not a crime listed under mandatory arrest. So it really ties the hands for police officers if that is the only crime left. And quite frankly, most strangulation cases, all we're left with is the harassment, which is the offensive touching. The difference between the bill that we have here today is it is not focusing on the intent to scare or the intent to threaten or the intent to cause serious physical injury, which is a very difficult thing to prove that someone is intending to kill somebody. What it's focusing on is what did the person actually do? What did they do? We're looking at did they knowingly use their hands or some part of the body in some method that they were knowingly putting pressure on their throat or their neck or blocking their nose or their mouth? Because that's what we have to prove. Of course, you know, defendants are going to come into court and they're going to say, no, I wasn't intending to cause them serious physical injury. I was just playing around. I was just trying to scare them. I was just, you know, doing something else. And then it's impossible for us to prove it. The majority of domestic violence cases that we prosecute, the victims, by the time we get to trial, are unwilling to testify. That may be for a lot of reasons, because they're scared of the person, because they're trying to get the relationship back together. There's a lot of reasons, but our job as deputy district attorneys is to hold that person accountable regardless. And so if we don't have a good investigation up front from a police officer with either a confession from a defendant that he was intending to cause serious physical injury, then it is going to be impossible for us to prove any of those kind of crimes. And going back to the physical injury, it again becomes extremely difficult. To show. Another thing that we want to focus on about the reasons we want this law is because it actually reflects what the defendant did. We want to show on when you run, when someone is arrested, both the police officer and the deputy district attorney have access to their criminal history, which is kept on LEDs. And we want, instead of looking at a crime that says harassment or a crime that says attempted assault too, it's like, well, what does that mean? What did the person really do? I want to be able to look at that criminal history and look at it where it says strangulation. And then I know exactly what this person has been convicted beyond a reasonable doubt of doing in the past so that I can adequately look at the case that I have before me and taking that in consideration. And then it will help prosecutors in other states and in other counties keep track of these people when they move around so they know what they did. It will also create consistency amongst all the counties and all the DDAs. Currently, I think that if you were to take a poll of all the counties, it's extremely inconsistent about how these cases are charged. So ultimately, we think that this bill, with its primary focus, that it really will be able to close down that loophole, and it will enable us to be able to prosecute these people for the crime that they actually committed. The way we have it worded here is that the crime itself is a misdemeanor, and then there are several aggravating factors that can make it a felony. And those aggravating factors are similar to the ones that are currently in 163-160 that make a misdemeanor assault for a felony assault for. They're the times when we feel that this crime is the most aggravated. When they actually did create or cause physical injury as the law is defined. If a weapon or dangerous weapon or deadly weapon was used, whether or not there was children that had witnessed it and whether they'd been convicted of doing it before. We think that all those things make it more aggravated situation, and then in those cases that the crime should rise to the level of a felony instead of a misdemeanor. In a moment, Lisa Fryer is going to testify, and she is a victim in a strangulation case that I prosecuted when I was in Marion County about a year ago. I asked her to come here before you and testify about what she felt and what she thought when she was being strangled by her assailant, who was her current husband at the time, and that I wanted to pass around the photographs that were taken of her injuries at the time to show that comparing what she's going to explain to you about what she was feeling and what she was thinking, that, quite frankly, there are none. There's nothing that you could see observable that would, if you were an arresting officer or if you were a prosecutor, that would enable you to go forward with any sort of theory that involved physical injury. And most prosecutors do not have the access to this wonderful woman that was here today providing you that medical testimony. We don't have, at least we're not aware of anyone that we can call in our area that can provide that kind of testimony. They're not out of the field with police officers. The police officers, most of them, as we've also heard testimony, do not have that kind of training. And so we're forced with just what can you see and just asking a couple questions, and that's what we're left with.
Thank you. Do you want to?
I'm Jean Kunkel. I am the trial team supervisor for the domestic violence trial team in Marion County. I would just reiterate what Ms. Skinner told the committee. I would also reiterate what the medical examiner testified to just briefly, in that one of the most recent strangulation cases that I had, it was just seconds that he had his hands on her throat, but during that time period, and until she lost consciousness, but during that time period, she testified to and told the police officer at the time that she was saying her prayers because she was convinced that she was going to die. And that time period that she was conscious for those brief few seconds were spent worrying about her children that were asleep upstairs and that they were going to be, frankly, motherless. So it only takes just such a brief period of time for unconsciousness to set in.
Thank you. Ms. Fryer, welcome.
Thank you. I just wanted to go over, I didn't even know where to start because I don't have that much time, but I just want to say that when our relationship started falling apart, I went through the normal things of getting a restraining order, going to the Women Crisis Center, talking with them, getting cell phones, carrying them with me, and giving one to my 10-year-old daughter to call 911 if she needed to. In that, I had taken their advice, taking different routes home, shopping at different stores, changing my whole routine, not going to church on Sundays, just changing our whole lifestyle, trying to stay safe from now my ex-husband. At one time, he did violate the restraining order and was picked up for that. 2 weeks later, around 9:30 at night, November 4th, 2002, I had sent my daughter upstairs to get ready for bed. I was unloading the last load of groceries out of the trunk of my car, and he ran up behind me and took me down to the ground from behind and was screaming he was going to kill me and continued to immediately start strangling me. The attack went on for minutes. My daughter was upstairs. She heard him screaming that he was going to kill me. She made a heroic 911 call, and her call lasted 45 minutes before the police came. While I was being strangled, I kept trying to get my hands up. My feet were literally bent behind me. I had ripped fingernails off, trying to get his hands off of me. I was going in and out of consciousness. I lost incontinency with urine. I just kept blacking out and coming to, and it seemed like he knew at one point where I was losing consciousness and would let up a little on the grip around my throat. And he just kept repeating that he was going to kill me. At one point, for some unknown reason, he picked me up and slammed me up against my car. And at that point, the police came and he took off, and thank goodness they caught him. It has left such big scars on my daughter and I. For one, the frustration of going through the court system is quite unbelievable. Knowing that somebody can attempt to take your life and not even be recognized for that. It is basically, there's nothing to protect victims like myself. You know, when he picked me up and slammed me against the car, I started dry heaving. And, of course, like I said, I had instantly lost my voice. My daughter has been so traumatized that she's still on medication to this day for the trauma that she has had, knowing that, you know, someone was trying to kill her mother. She didn't know what was going to happen to her, if he was going to come in the house and get her. And at one point, she would sit in her closet and rip her hair out, and it's just been just a tremendous, tremendous ordeal that my 10-year-old has gone through because of this situation. Even knowing that he is in prison today, she still fears that someone is, you know, he's going to ask someone to kill me or to kill her, and so it's an ongoing reassurance that we have to instill in her that she is safe.
Chair Williams, I think that one of the main reasons that we asked Ms. Fryer to come here today, with her testimony in conjunction with the photographs, is just to point out that the majority of these cases that are investigated by road cops or police officers that do not have any extensive training in asking the right questions and any medical background to be able to understand all these periphery, physical ailments that could piece together into what is strangulation. And that if you look at those photographs there, that's what they saw that night. And that we need to give the police officers a tool that they can use to hold someone like the assailant in this case accountable when all you can see is what you saw in those photographs.
Well, we appreciate very much you coming forward, and particularly you, Ms. Fryer. We understand how difficult it must be to come sit in a large room and talk about your experiences again, and we do appreciate you sharing those with the committee. Are there questions by any of the committee members for this panel? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next up, I have Ms. McCluskey, is that right? And Elaine Walters. Ms. Walters? Yeah, okay, great. Please proceed, Ms. McCluskey.
Good afternoon. My name is Miley McCluskey, and I am an advocate that has been working in the domestic violence field for about 6 years. And most of my experience with advocacy has been in conjunction with law enforcement. Basically, what I'm going to start off with today is a quote from a survivor that I worked with the night after she had been strangled. And in this particular case, the perpetrator was not arrested. And it is, "I thought I was going to die. I just began to pray it would not be my children that found my body. I just wanted it to end. I had accepted it." And basically, this is a quote from this one particular survivor. However, it's also very representative of many of the women that have been strangled that I've worked with. This is a very similar kind of thing that is often felt by survivors that have been strangled. Many times they believe they are going to die. Many times they have accepted the fact. And many times they worry about, will it be my children that will find me? And strangulation is a common type of physical abuse used by perpetrators to physically and emotionally assault their victims. And it's something that is devastating, because who at that point has the complete control? It is the person that is strangling. The effects of being strangled is both physically and emotionally devastating. Although strangulation often does not, as we have heard, leave visible marks, but the impact is clear. "I thought I was going to die." Strangulation is one of the most lethal forms of violence used by the perpetrator. However, the tools available to hold the perpetrator accountable are inadequate, and it's for many of the reasons that have already been relayed. And the thing that is hard to remember is that we hear about these extreme cases, but there's a lot of strangulation that goes on that marks aren't left, that they may not lose consciousness, but basically what ends up happening is the impact is very much the same. The House Bill 2270 is a tool that would increase the accountability of offenders, and most importantly, it would enhance the safety of many victims. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Poplawski. Ms. Walters.
Hi, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I'm here today. I just finished a six-year project under a Centers for Disease Control grant working with healthcare systems in Lane County around the issue of domestic violence. I'm also a member of the Governor's Council on Domestic Violence. And while I'm not here representing the consensus of that body, I can tell you that one of the benefits of being a member of that group is that we've gone all over the state of Oregon listening to survivors and providers who are working to address domestic violence in their communities. And one of the biggest concerns that we hear, both from survivors and law enforcement, frankly, is the confusion at the scene around whether or not there's been imminent harm and whether or not they can respond to the fear that gets reflected. And the experience of strangulation, what you've heard is sort of the damage it can cause. The level of terror that a person experiences on the scene can't be measured in the marks that are left on them, and that's been made clear today, too. The other thing that working in the healthcare system has made really evident is that when there is a crime that's clearly defined, people kick into gear in a lot of different ways. And so, for example, the felony upgrade legislation that made it a more serious, the assault, if children were present, for example, made our hospital personnel respond to screening and intervening with those cases in a very different way. And we hear the same thing from law enforcement, that once there was a felony upgrade clause in that law, they were able to respond and to get training and support around responding to that crime in a very different way. And the same thing would be true in this case, that it would clarify the ability to respond, it would clarify the ability to arrest as well as to prosecute these cases. And we've heard it as members of the Governor's Council all over the state as a critical and priority issue that people would like to see clarified and established.
Thank you very much, Ms. Walters. Are there questions for either Ms. McCluskey or Ms. Walters? Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. The last witness we have this afternoon is Susan Russell from the OCDLA. Hi, Susan. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Tough room this afternoon.
Susan Russell on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. And I'm here to appreciate that this is a serious matter and that the concerns that have been expressed today really deserve attention. I also appreciate that injury can occur quickly when dealing with what's been described as strangulation. That House Bill 2770 attempts to address these concerns by creating the new crime of strangulation. Our concerns are that is the language used. In particular, our concern is that House Bill 2770 does not require that the defendant intend to cause harm as an element of the crime. It merely requires that the defendant unknowingly impede the normal breathing of the victim or the circulation of his or her blood by doing one of two things, applying pressure to the throat or neck or blocking the nose or mouth of the victim. Knowingly is defined under Oregon law as an awareness of circumstances, not an intent or a conscious objective to achieve that result. Not only does House Bill 2770 not require that the defendant intend to cause harm, it also doesn't require that any harm occur. There's been some reference here to strangulation in terms of hands on throat, but that's not actually required at all by the statute. It isn't actually required that the the impediment to breathing is caused by the defendant's hand. And we're talking in terms of abstracts, and I'll give you a couple examples. I put them in my written testimony about matters that we think could be included or could fall within the definition of strangulation, and clearly it's not the intentions of the proponents of this bill to include such conduct. Wrestling, football, or other kinds of contact sports activities. A lifeguard rescue attempt. A police or security officers arresting an individual or removing an individual from an unwanted premise. Privacy act between consenting adults where there's neither an intention to harm and no harm is caused. A poor civilian attempt to resuscitate an individual may not qualify as legitimate medical procedure, but yet the individual's mouth or nose may be blocked in the process. There may be acts of a poorly a parent who is acting badly under the circumstances. By badly, I mean making poor decisions, but not intending to harm a child. A parent may cover the mouth of a crying child, trying to calm the child down. It's a misguided attempt, but they're not intending to harm that child, and the child may not be harmed. A parent may hold a child down during a tantrum, in the process of which block the child's ability to breathe, block the child's mouth or nose, or somehow cover or impede their breathing. Yet the parent does not intend to harm the child. Again, is misguided in trying to calm the child down. It's our proposal that House Bill 2070 require some intent to cause harm. There are a number of alternatives. One alternative would be to include that the requirement that the defendant act with the intent to cause serious physical injury or death. The intent to cause serious physical injury does not actually require that the defendant cause serious physical injury, but just that under the circumstances that there is a substantial risk of death. Not that there's actually a substantial risk of death, that the defendant intended a substantial risk of death or protracted impairment. There are other and lesser standards of injury as well, which would be available to the committee. One of those is significant physical injury, which would require that the defendant intend a risk of death that is not remote. There's also physical injury, intention to cause physical injury. Again, physical injury need not be caused, but simply that the defendant intended to cause substantial pain. And again, intention is different than knowingly. It is a higher standard, and what it requires is not that a defendant is aware, but that the defendant intends that. I mean, it's a conscious objective. So, for example, when we're talking about sports activity or the parent isn't acting, or the sports participant isn't acting with a conscious objective to cause harm, even though they knowingly may be aware of the circumstances and be guilty of the offense. Our other concern is with one of the aggravating factors, and in particular with number C. And by number C, this would elevate strangulation to a Class C felony punishable by 5 years imprisonment if the defendant causes physical injury. In general, when physical injury is caused under Oregon law by a defendant or an actor using their own hands, meaning not using a weapon, such as the strangulation bill provides, it is a Class A misdemeanor, punishable up to 1 year in jail. So what you would have is sort of a disproportionate sentencing depending upon whether the defendant caused injury as defined under 2770 as opposed to the defendant, let's say, hit someone. And so our concern is that that would lead to disproportionate punishment where the conduct and the physical injury that results is of the same category, meaning that it's mere physical injury. Under current law, just remind the committee, under current law, if a defendant causes serious physical injury, as defined under House Bill 2770, it is a Class B felony of assault in the second degree, punishable by up to 10 years in prison, and it's a Measure 11 mandatory minimum sentence of 70 months. So when a defendant actually causes serious physical injury, which is a substantial risk of death, and I think some of the circumstances that were defined or that were testified before in terms of an individual's, in a very short period of time, being rendered unconscious. I think that that does qualify. So I just wanted the court to know, the committee to know that under circumstances as outlined by some of the testimony, there are some very serious penalties that do exist and have and can be applied to such cases.
Thank you, Ms. Russell. Are there questions for Ms. Russell? Representative Brzezinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Susan, I'm going to ask you if you would consider, regarding the intent issue that you've raised, whether you think this would take care of the concerns that you've brought forward today. This would be under Section 2, line B1, it's line 7. At the conclusion, after where it says, currently it says, a person commits the crime of strangulation if the person knowingly, and then inserting the following, with the intent to cause harm by, and then picking up with line 8. If you could consider that, and you may not want be able to respond to it now, but understanding what your concerns may be, one of my concerns is, based on what you've have brought forward, would put us back to the same scenario that we're trying to address. Mm-hmm. And we're, you know, if we're conscious of having some level of intention, it seems like it should be to the actual conduct that we're trying to stop.
Mr. Chair, Representative Brzezinski, I think that sounds like a good suggestion. I'd like to look at that language and think about it. But yeah, I think that type of language being inserted, it doesn't necessarily need to be inserted later, but perhaps in that context might be a good way to address the concerns we have and at the same time not present such a high hurdle that it's not going to be able, that the statute wouldn't be able to address the concerns that the proponents have provided. So,
okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes, follow up.
Based on what I've just asked, I will be contacting the witnesses who have testified from the district attorney's offices in Washington and Marion County to get their input as well.
Okay. Representative Barker, had you signaled?
Yes, I did. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Susan, one of the problems, something you're talking about where somebody is maybe trying to quiet the child down, I've been to, as you probably can well imagine, many of these domestic violence cases, and I've heard many times, I'm just trying to quiet the bitch down, just trying to calm the bitch down. I mean, and so this, I have grave concern that I don't want to create an excuse that somebody can get away with strangling their partner and just say, well, I'm just trying to calm her down. I mean, that's a real, I mean, your explanation of that just really caused me great heartache just sitting here, hearing that.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Parker, I agree that is a concern, and there are a number of excuses that are used by defendants to justify their conduct that are ludicrous. And the problem is that sometimes in some circumstances, for example, talking about a parent that has poor parenting skills who's dealing with an unruly four-year-old, it could be that the same thing she says is the same thing that an adult male with a long history of domestic violence. And so I think with some elements, such as with the intent to cause harm being inserted, it would provide an opportunity for the trial determiner, the jury, or the court to look at the specific circumstances and not to catch misplaced, you know, but not ill-intended conduct. So I understand your concerns, but it's hard when we're talking about a big category to figure out a way to separate the ones that are really acting bad as opposed to the ones that either are acting innocuously or with, as I say, poor judgment.
Next up, Representative Shetterly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just thinking about circumstances like the lifeguard rescue attempt that you've listed on your... don't we have already in statute exemptions, I mean, under defense of other, justification, necessity, don't we have statutes that would already exempt that kind of conduct when it's with intent to rescue or to save or, I guess, you know where I'm going.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Sherrill, I think kind of good Samaritan type laws, I think there is some I would be concerned to rely on those if it's conduct that the committee does not intend to criminalize. I know that there are proposals to extend those Good Samaritan laws that are being considered this session precisely because of a concern in a sort of a terrorist reaction, whether the present law adequately accommodates people who would come forth to give assistance that aren't medically qualified or trained. I think that a lot of the my understanding of the laws is that they were better protecting medically trained people than they are the sort of Good Samaritan off the street that has not such training.
Follow up purposes.
Well, we can talk about this later. We don't need to take up more time. But it's not so much Good Samaritan. It seems to me we have some specific justification statutes in the criminal code that at least would be worth looking at. I know that looking at Virginia Vanderbilt's letter with regard to the proposed Dash 1 amendments and the police exemption, she says, you don't really need that because you've already got a statute that covers that, and the risk, I guess the danger of starting to create that specific exemption in some statutes is that are we inferring that the exemption doesn't apply in others? It seems to me if we've got a general statute that grants an exemption for justification or defense of others or defense of self, that kind of thing, I'd be comfortable in leaving those kind of circumstances in that statute and not creating a specific exemption in this one.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Sheriff, there are specific defenses, for example, choice of evils, which would give a defendant charged with a crime an argument that would say that my choice was to have a greater often crime or evil take place or to commit a crime in order to avoid that greater evil. Necessity is not a very commonly used, it's a common law primarily defense, and so there are a number of issues that do exist, and depending on the circumstances could apply, for example, to a lifeguard. That's one of the examples I gave, but I think that the problem in my mind is that there are a number of examples that go from the lifeguard to a sports participant to a parent that really don't fall in one nice particular category, and that the thing that unites them is this lack of a desire to harm.
Okay. Representative Crummell, then Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Your sports analogies, I'm really having a struggle with that, having spent most of my adult life professionally involved with athletics, wrestling and football and many other sports. And I'm really trying to figure out where you would have an act of strangulation occurring particularly in the examples that you gave, but in any other sporting activity where it's a stretch for me, I guess, is what I'm trying. And I can you expand on that a little bit?
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, I can give some examples that would come to my mind. And I think that they come to my mind because when we talk about strangulation, I think we think about someone putting their hands around someone's neck and cutting off the circulation of air. And I would agree that I wouldn't think that that is something that happens very often in a sports activity or it's tolerated in a sports activity. But the way the strangulation bill defines strangulation is by blocking the nose or mouth of a person, and it doesn't have to be, again, in the traditional sense of the hand covering the nose or the mouth. It can be simply that the person does something that causes that person's mouth or nose to be blocked, and also by applying pressure on the throat or neck. So when I'm thinking of things, for example, in football, to tackle someone in such a way that their mouth or nose are blocked during the tackle, or that pressure is applied on their throat or neck in the way that they are tackled. Similarly, in wrestling, again, my hypothetical would be that someone takes someone down, and I'll defer to you on the terms that apply in a wrestling match, but where somebody has somebody or that interacts with somebody in such a way that without doing an act as we would in laypersons, you know, characterize as strangulation, applies pressure on that the opponent's neck and interferes with the circulation of the blood or air. So those are the kind of hypotheticals I was thinking, not in terms of sort of a classic hypothetical of strangulation.
Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Russell, I want to focus on the disproportionality concern that you mentioned. It would seem to me that the reason why we attach more serious criminal penalties to acts of violence committed with a weapon is because of the greater probability of inflicting serious harm on the victim. And what the testimony we were receiving earlier, what I think it one point it drove home is that in this one particular way, there's the potential for inflicting serious physical injury with one's bare hands. And so I'm wondering whether in that particular situation, one shouldn't regard that as being on a par with an armed assault. I want to get your reaction to that.
And Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, there are a number of other ways in which an individual, I think, can cause or takes on a risk of causing, you know, serious physical injury to an individual that would fall in a similar category. I mean that presently they would be sort of an unarmed conduct, that physical injury is all that occurs, but that the circumstances are such that there is some risk that a serious physical injury or death could occur. For example, physical injury can include something that's sort of the most minimal of substantial pain to somebody punching another person where the size is very disproportionate, full on in the face or in another part of the body where there's really, under the circumstances, quite a risk of serious physical injury, some type of life-threatening or impairment that's going to be protracted. So there are, I think, other situations that would be similar, I think, in terms of the risks that are involved. I appreciate that the testimony that it takes a minimal amount of force and that when we're talking about strangulation because of the sort of sensitivity of that part of an individual's body and the breathing sort of apparatus. But I think that there are sort of similar, I won't say similar, but there is conduct that would lead to a disproportionate sort of outcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it's pretty inherent in the legitimate medical procedures, but there is communication here that indicates that some communication that dental procedures would be included in that. Either if the language is taken out regarding medical procedures, be fine. If not, I'd suggest that we put medical or dental procedures. I can't think of a medical or a dental procedure that would cause strangulation other than possibly untoward aspiration of some object in the mouth, and with physicians or dentists that do procedures around the mouth, I'd like to just make that part of the record.
Good. Thank you, Representative. Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In your testimony, you make the distinction between a Class C, under current law, a Class C felony, and a Class A misdemeanor, or between Assault 3 and Assault 4. And you say generally under Oregon law, when physical injury is caused by an unarmed person, it's a Class A misdemeanor, not a felony. And I guess my question, given the testimony that we had initially about how little strength is needed to stop the flow of blood in the carotid arteries if the hands are not a deadly weapon.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Jones, I believe that there is case law that has addressed this issue that a part of a defendant's body can't constitute a dangerous weapon. So I think that's if your question is why, if somebody is using intending to use such force to strangle someone, why doesn't it qualify the conduct for a weapons aggravated assault charge? Is that correct?
Yes.
And that's my understanding, is that it's a matter of interpretation of what a weapon constitutes.
Perhaps that's an issue we should address.
Okay, thank you. Okay, thank you very much. Representative Przanski, we did have the Dash 1 amendments in front of us, and I saw Ms. Vanderbilt's letter, and based on your testimony, I'm assuming you're going to be working on additional amendments to the bill. So with that, we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2770. I appreciate all of you being here. We'll work with Representative Przanski on the bill, and he'll work with the various stakeholders as well. We're next committee going to move back up to the top of the agenda, and I'm going to open a hearing, but I'm going to give an opportunity for everybody who doesn't want to stick around for a bill on court facilities to clear out of the
room. As your
chair knows how to open or empty a room.
See you, everybody.
Okay.
See
you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, committee members have to stay. The rest of you are free to leave.
Yes.
If we could get everybody as quickly who isn't here for committee business out of the room as possible, I'd appreciate it. And as quietly as possible, because we've got to move on with other business on our agenda. So I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2073 and ask Mr. Harnden if he'd join me at the desk.
Gentlemen, for the record.
I'm State Representative Max Williams, House District 35.
I'm Ed Harnden, past president of the Oregon State Bar.
And I appreciate the committee's attention on this bill. The bill in front of you is a bill that spent a considerable amount of time in front of the House Judiciary Committee last session relative to the creation of a task force to address the issue of court facilities in Oregon. It's tougher, frankly, to bring this bill to you now than it was then, because we're in a lot worse financial condition now than we were 2 years ago at this time. But the issue hasn't gone away. We have serious, serious issues in probably almost all of your counties. All of you represent various parts of counties in this state that have significant challenges with respect to the status of Oregon's courthouses. There are very few, with the exception of perhaps Representative Garrard from Klamath Falls, who had the good fortune to have his essentially shake down during an earthquake, and thankfully when no one was there, and get rebuilt. The rest of us have county courthouses, many of which, including Multnomah County's courthouse, that will come down in the next big tumbler that happens to go through that community. On top of the facilities are old. They are in many respects struggling from a maintenance standpoint. Beyond that, they have challenges with respect to safety and security. That people, when we were building these courthouses, some of them historical in their own right, weren't given a lot of consideration to the issues that face us modernly about how to keep a courthouse secure, given the issues that are faced there. So there has been an effort to try to develop some approach to solving this problem. And it's a big problem, and it's not one that we're going to solve right away. But I believe it's a problem that if we put a little effort behind this bill, we can at least begin what's going to have to be the long-term discussion in working with all the partners on this issue, both courthouses, their counties,
the staff of the people who actually work in the courthouses and the courts about how we want this process to develop over what literally might be the next 30 or 40 years as we seriously have to address this issue of public facilities. There's a historical incident that occurred about the time that the state took over indigent defense, and the deal was made that, you know, the employees of the courts would become employees of the state in the indigent defense issue, and the counties would provide the courthouses. And we've been struggling in sort of this dual relationship of landlord and tenant in some counties for some period of time. And I'll just be real frank, you're going to have the participants and the stakeholders come up and talk to you in a few minutes. I've been frustrated to a great degree about our inability to come to some agreement about how to move forward with this discussion. Mr. Harnden, to my right, was the president of the Oregon State Bar during the last legislative session. He agreed to work with me on a task force during the interim in an informal way where we spent a fair amount of time with the stakeholders trying to come to some agreed approach to the bill, and we frankly just weren't successful. Now, I'm not sure what you'll hear later today as the stakeholders come up and talk. I hope what they're going to tell you is they've worked out a set of amendments they're all going to be holding hands on. I will tell you that if they haven't, I'm still going to press very hard for this bill, regardless of whether they agree with it or not, because I think if we don't put something in place, we're never going to get this issue addressed. And if that motivation helps bring everybody together and sing a happy song, then I'm all in favor of it. If it doesn't, I think it's up to us to make a decision about how we're going to move forward with this issue. And if we ignore it, it'll just continue to be ignored for a long period of time. And I'd much rather have the recommendations of a thoughtful task force in the future about how we're going to address the long-term needs of our courthouses than simply blithely going down the road waiting for the collision and the continuing challenges that exist between these two disparate landlord and tenant relationships to develop any further acrimony than they already have. So with that, I'm going to allow Mr. Harnden to make his opening remarks, and I'll return to the chair when he's finished, after I take your thoughtful questions.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm not sure that was a good tap dance handoff, but I'll accept it. I was a little surprised that everyone left to go watch us in the other room rather than stay here, but be that as it may. It has been a long-standing concern of mine and interest in the efficient way we handle justice, not just, you know, do we have bright, shiny doors into the courthouse, and are the, you know, courtrooms solid wood or not solid wood? And I don't think anyone at this point certainly has that in mind. But what I have had a concern with is that efficient handling of the justice that we dispense from our courthouse, the safe dispensing of that justice, and the ability of the public, you know, your constituents, to access that justice. And we're not doing it in a very safe or efficient fashion right now. And that's the reason for the bill, from my mind. We have a situation out there in almost every county, and it does vary, with very few having had an earthquake strike, which allowed the building of the new building, and very few having any funding sources to make sure that deferred maintenance holes, which are ever expanding, are even slightly filled. So what we are left with are not concerns just with the suitable and sufficient facilities, but with facilities that are clearly unsafe. When I mentioned to one of my business colleagues in Portland, and I serve on it, the Multnomah County Commissioner Lynn's special committee on replacing or remodeling the Multnomah County Courthouse, because the findings are that it is earthquake unsuitable, the person asked me whether he should really be concerned about the lawyers that might be in the building when the earthquake struck. He was a little concerned about judges, but wasn't sure whether he should be. And I thought, if I were you, I wouldn't be concerned about either one. But I do know that you go there to file some papers, so you got to count your ticks of the clock just right to not be there at the right time. That concerned him a little bit, maybe not enough. There is some ancient history, and I do think it's ancient history. The water's gone long ago under the bridge of whether the judges pay versus facilities versus new facilities versus maintenance is one group or another group's responsibility. We did struggle with it in the interim before the last session. We struggled in the last session, and we struggled in the interim. We developed a good set of principles. We started with priorities, and we developed what I believe was a very good set of potential statutes that would allow us to address the issues and decide or determine what the information was we had, what we needed, and what was suitable. Not great, not gold-plated, but what is suitable. I suspect that many look at the plan and say, is this a five-star plan? Is that what we're looking at? And I suggest to you that we should be looking at a three-star plan that gets us to a point where we can do the job that we tell the public we're there to do and that they're safe when they come into the courts. I'm applying the SIM and CAM standards for the three and five-star, in case any of you were wondering. It's a tough group. I need those people back. Let me cover just for a second what I think the issues are, because they come up. And these are the issues that, if you'll look at Section 2, are within that parameter to cover. The courthouse in almost every community is the core and the heart of the local community, and we're treating them with in different manners. It's a long-term public safety issue, and how does that play into design? Developing minimum standards of what is suitable and sufficient, and we set out that there are differences probably in different areas of the state as to what the circumstances are that allow for changes in the courts, what are the localized needs, and what are the funding sources. And Section 7 and others in the bill address that. Who bears the responsibility for not just building, but for improving or maintaining? What are the costs of the needed changes? And that varies by locality in each of your various bailiwicks. What are the utilization issues? Do we need single courtrooms for every judge? What size? If it's a single courtroom county, does that change things? Can we use other facilities? What's the flexibility that's needed? And certainly the technology has far outstripped anything we have, but we simply can't use it, at least to its greatest effect. And does that change what we need in the cost-benefit analysis? And perhaps most importantly, I think this bill allows you to start the prioritization process. We, again, aren't able to do that now because each group out there is having to try to address it themselves and recreate various wheels. What are the court needs in the various areas? What are the priorities between the counties? Why should we do this now? We're probably 5 years to 10 years behind, but this is a part of your planning process, and it gives you a plan to work with. It gives you recommendations. It gives you basic information, and it gives you expert information in those areas. Last, I will say that lawyers are most subject to this in my mind, which is when things are rosy, we tend to sit back and relax, kind of stare at the ceiling a bit, and count our lucky stars that things are rosy. When things are difficult, and there's no doubt that you have the difficult jobs and I don't, it does in Oregon mean that not only lawyers but the legislators tend to roll up their sleeves, work hardest, and generate some of our most innovative ideas and innovative approaches. And I think this group, if put together, provides you with the basics of the information and the basics of the innovations that are possible out there and what will work and what won't. I would ask you to pass this bill. I believe that the others who will speak, who have participated in these various meetings over the last couple of years or longer with your chairman and myself, are clearly attuned to the fact that we long ago passed the ability to either cross fingers pointing back and forth or to try to make sure we've dotted I's, but let's get on with it. Thank you very much.
Questions for the committee? Hearing none, job well done.
Thank you.
Okay.
But we were thoughtful.
What bill are we on?
Okay, so let's bring up in panels, how about the county folks. Is that all right? We start with the county folks. So Commissioner Doherty, Paul Snyder, okay, Paul. Is there anybody else?
Is John Powell still here?
John Powell, you want to come up? Okay.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Dennis Doherty. I'm a county commissioner in Umatilla County. I live in Hermiston. Excuse me. If it's okay with you, we'll start with the C team and then we'll go to the A and B team. I'll just make some general comments and Paul Snyder will present the more substantive matters. For 4 years, I've been traveling to Portland and Salem periodically for meetings to deal with this subject. It wasn't new when I started doing that because for at least 4 years before that, to my knowledge, the issue of state court facilities has been on county commissioners' minds. And the reason it's on their minds is that we have the statutory duty to provide suitable and sufficient facilities, and frankly, we haven't been able to do that. In my county, we have the same situation, maybe even worse, that the chair was talking about earlier. Our Hermiston facility, as Representative Jensen knows, is simply not adequate. It's not professional. It's not really even safe. And it is not what a co-equal branch of our government deserves to do the business that they constitutionally have to do. So the process that we've been engaging in for these years is to have a series of work groups to try to bring the conflicting interests of states, state courts, county people together. And where we really conflict is over who's going to pay for this solution. If you're a county person, your options are maybe set aside some money from the general fund and gradually build up money to produce a facility, or maybe possibly get the voters to pass a bond. In our county, that's just not possible. And it really hasn't been possible to do it through setting aside money in our general fund. This year, I've made 12 budget presentations to our county workforce groups, three unions, exempts, et cetera. And the question I most constantly get is, well, how can you talk about asking us to take a wage freeze or a wage reduction or reduce our benefits when you've got money sitting in this fund for the West County Government and Justice Center? And I don't know if I'll be able to keep that money fenced out, but I think I will. It's just not enough to get the job done, and that's where this bill comes in. We've had a good process, and it got moved up to a higher level last year because of Mr. Williams' participation, and that brought us to a new level. But what we need to do now is go to the next level, and House Bill 2073 is the path to get this to the next level, because what the previous speakers said is true. I do want to say that I don't think we have a dogfight. We do have some soft spots between the interests of counties and the interests of the judiciary and stuff, but they're really just soft spots at this point. I think what we have here is a bill that you should be able to support. I certainly support it. It's gone through three levels of review in the Association of Oregon Counties and pretty much passed muster there. Excuse me. We are offering some amendments. I don't think they should be controversial amendments. I believe that they will actually make it a better bill. I understand just today that maybe the judiciary group has some other amendments. I am not familiar with their amendments, so my position on the amendments is what you probably usually hear. If they support our amendments, we'll probably support their amendments. I'm just kidding about that. I do hope that you will be receptive to the bill and give Max Williams, your chair, the chance to take this bill as far as he can. It'll be good for all of us.
Thank you, Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties. As the testimony that you've already heard has indicated, this pilgrimage started for us in 1981 when the state took over the trial court system. That was a result of the work of the Commission on the Judicial Branch, and that report, which was later adopted by the legislature, said that the state should take over both the revenues and the expenses of the circuit and district court system. It also said that the county should be responsible for providing suitable and sufficient court facilities. Since that time, it's become abundantly clear that you could take any two people anywhere in the state of Oregon and ask them what that phrase means, and you get a different answer. And that's been the crux of the problem ever since. But there's been a little bit more to it. A lot of things have changed since 1981, other than the passage of 22 years. In one respect, I'd like to emphasize that we are honored today to have in the audience the former executive director of the Association of Oregon Counties, on whose watch all this happened, and that is Jerry Orrick. With him is our current executive director, Bob Cantine. Between the two of them, we got about 35 years of executive directorship with the Association of Oregon Counties. And Jerry was very much involved with this legislation. It was intended to accomplish good things both for the state and for the counties. For the state, it would create a unified court system for the first time ever. For the counties, it would relieve us of a burden that, frankly, the counties couldn't control, and that were the operational costs of the circuit and the district courts. Jerry was very insightful in the way all this was put together, and one example of his insightfulness that I still remember is that in 1990, when he said that he's going to leave us to dry out and warm up by taking over the executive directorship of the Arizona Association of Counties, as he walked out the door, he said, "Don't worry about that Measure 5 thing too much. That's not going to pass." Well, it did. And so did Measure 47. So did Measure 50. The Endangered Species Act came along, and the primary revenue sources for counties started to shrivel up like a prune. It was the property tax and it was forestry seats. At the same time and during the same period, the population of Oregon increased substantially, the workloads of the courts increased substantially, and the complexity and the dimensions of the cases the courts had to deal with also increased substantially. So we had a revenue problem for the counties and a workload increase for the courts, and that's exacerbated the problems that we've had ever since. House Bill 2073 is intended to address that issue, and we support a resolution to this problem. AOC has proposed some amendments. I think you have them before you. They're the Dash 1 amendments. And as Commissioner Doherty has indicated, they're intended, our hope is that there'll be an improvement over the bill, and the bill is pretty good to begin with. One portion of the bill adds a sheriff to the membership of the task force that's intended to address this issue. This came as the result of a request from the State Sheriff's Association, and we agreed to support it. And the reason for it, as Mr. Powell can give you more detail about, is that simply the sheriffs are responsible for the security of these facilities, and they need to be involved with the design of the facilities so that they can provide the security adequately. They indicated that is their purpose, and we agreed with it, and we support their amendment. Other amendments to the bill that AOC is offering is to add to the responsibility of the task force some things that we think somebody needs to do, and we don't see it identified anywhere else. One of them is to, as it gets into the process of looking at each separate courthouse and each separate court facility, the task force is by necessity going to have to draw some conclusions about where is the urgency of the need the greatest, where are the prospects for moving forward the best. And although the bill provides a means for distinguishing among counties, we think it would be valuable for the task force to consider other criteria in addition to just the population of the county. So the Dash 1 amendments recommend that the task force take into account in its recommendations other things, like basically the ability of the local jurisdiction to proceed, is where is the urgency of the need the greatest? What is the tax base of the local county? What is the financial circumstance of the county? What is the ability of that county to proceed further and more immediately than others? And to recommend to you, you don't have to accept it, but to recommend to you some way to prioritize where these projects ought to be done first. Another would be to prioritize the projects, to take into consideration the other criteria. Another provision of the AOC amendment is to reduce the increase. The way House Bill 2073 proposes to fund the responsibilities of the task force is through an increase in the unitary assessment. The unitary assessment has evolved a great deal over the last six or so years. It's increased a lot. It's received top priority in terms of what things are paid. And we have been advised by the minor courts, the municipal courts, and the justice courts that these increases are causing some cash flow problems for those courts. We took a look at the the Department of Administrative Services fiscal impact statement, and we recommend to you that the increase in the unitary assessment, both to address the concerns of the minor courts and to bring the revenue somewhere within the ballpark of what the likely costs of the task force are to be, increase it by $1 rather than $2. I understand that the Judicial Department will have some amendments as well. We've been presented with them. We discussed them very briefly yesterday, and we faxed them out to our members. We haven't had sufficient responses, Mr. Chair and members, to tell you what our reaction is, but the preliminary reaction from two respondents is they don't look too bad. Well, that's the wrong way to characterize it. They don't have a problem, but that's two out of 15 people, and so I can't tell you yet whether that's our position, but I can tell you that the preliminary reaction is positive. Mr. Chair and members, there's another provision that says changes the bill a little bit with respect to the Department of Administrative Services. Under the printed bill, come July 1st of the year 2005, the Department of Administrative Services will receive authority to award grants to counties. One provision is to say that the department will also, by rule, adopt standards for suitable and sufficient facilities. So if a county wants the money, the county agrees to comply with the standards. If you don't want to live with the standards, then don't apply for the money. One of the concerns that we have had throughout the process is to avoid, as well as we can, the prospect of winding up with standards that raise the bar without funding to pay the costs. It's an outcome that is just the opposite of what we hope to accomplish through this process. So to address that issue, we made some recommendations. Legislative Council raised some issues with our approach, and what you have instead of what we recommended, but which is okay with us, is Section 6 on page 1 of the Dash 1 amendments. That's the highlighted Section 6. So in other words, it says Department of Administrative Services won't release the funds until the legislature has adopted the standards. And our hope is that when you adopt the standards, you'll also adopt a funding mechanism to meet the cost of paying for the standards. I would like to commend the chair for his dedication to this issue and for his dedication to an outcome that improves the circumstances for everybody concerned. And we take it at face value that there will be a strong effort not to create standards without funding to provide pay for the standards. Chair Williams has said that's his intent. We hope the rest of the committee also adopts that as a purpose with respect to this bill. I think, Mr. Chair and members, I'm done unless you have questions, and Mr. Powell can speak with the Sheriff's Association changes.
Go ahead. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Powell, representing the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. And Mr. Schneider has correctly stated our position of asking for a sheriff to be on this task force for the specific purpose of trying to get ahead of the curve in terms of security.
as I think the chair mentioned in his testimony, today's world security is vital in these buildings, not only in public buildings, but if you go to very many large privately owned buildings today, security is a major issue there as well. So this part of the amendment would be to address that concern and to have somebody on the task force to be vigilant about standards and security issues as it moves forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions for the panel? Okay. Thank you, Jim. Okay, let's bring up the bar. Marilyn O'Dell, Tom Kranovich, Bob Olson. And as a program note, colleagues, because of it just seems a day where we're running over time on anything or on everything, we're going to finish up and go to the quick hearing on 2115. And I'm just going to make the executive decision today that we are not going to go to work session on 2047, 2091, or 2110. We'll hold those over and have to work them on another day. Please begin, whoever's going to lead off. Nice to see all of you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Bob Olson, Oregon State Bar. I'm here today with the Judicial Administration Committee of the Oregon State Bar. We will try to be very brief. There's been a lot of talk about the deals that were made in 83 and the financial public financing changes that have occurred since then, and this is all following up on that. Various bar groups have been involved in this issue for a long time. Currently, the committee most involved in this issue is the Judicial Administration Committee. The two of the leaders of that committee, Tom Kranovich and Marilyn O'Dell, are here today to make a brief statement.
Marilyn? Chair Williams, members of the committee, my name is Marilyn O'Dell. I'm an assistant attorney general, although I'm appearing here today on behalf of the bar. We're here testifying in favor of this bill. We believe that it's of paramount importance that there are adequate court facilities, that it's important to the administration of justice, and it's very important to the role of the courthouse in the local community. We recognize that our courthouse facilities have fallen into various levels of disrepair, and some of them are quite urgently in need of assistance. The counties, much like the state, have found themselves in some difficult financial conundrums, and without a partnership that's offered by this bill, making those needed improvements and ensuring that the courts are able to carry on the important work that they do for all of us, will be in jeopardy. We think that the comprehensive manner in which this bill addresses the issue is appropriate. We like the composition of the committee and think that having a broad representation and maintaining some equal numbers is a good goal and generally believe that the county's proposal as far as the hit to the unitary assessment is probably a more realistic dollar drain on that system than perhaps the proposal under the bill, given the varying demands that are going to be made for that source of funding. We also would like to applaud the leadership of the chair of this committee in really moving this issue forward, and we remain willing to do whatever we can to assist you with moving this bill forward.
Thank you very much. Tom?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I really don't have anything to add other than I would wish to second. You know, that's a lawyerly response. I have nothing to add, and then you start adding. Right. Forgive me. But I would second the comment that Marilyn has made about your efforts in getting this issue back off the back burner and back onto a front burner. I was in a courthouse earlier this week in which jurors, because they didn't have a jury assembly room, were sitting in the hallway commingling with every spare person that was coming in and out of the courthouse. This impacts our ability to have to do what we call due process and make sure that our juries are are properly sequestered, that improper information isn't exchanging place. The need, I think everyone agrees, is there. I think getting this bill passed is going to start the process in motion to accomplish the task that really needs to be done, which is to improve our judicial facilities. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank all three of you. Is there any questions for any of the panel? Appreciate it. Thank you. District Attorney Dugan, you had signed up on this bill?
I am, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Mike Dugan. I'm the District Attorney from Deschutes County, and I would like to point out that I believe that Mr. Harkleroad from Lane County, the District Attorney, there has been participant in the discussions through the interim about this bill, and he suggested, and I would suggest as well, that one of the members of that task force be a district attorney. We seem to use the courtrooms a whole lot and probably know a little bit about them, so that's what I'm here to add. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much.
That is being an issue.
Okay, Janie Delani, am I going to get that right? Maybe she had to leave. Is she here, Ms. Delani, from the Oregon Disabilities Commission? She must have had to leave. Committee, you've got a copy of the testimony that she was going to present. Their request is that the task force be requested to consult the Oregon Disabilities Commission for technical assistance on structural and communication access issues for persons with disabilities. So we'll add that to the file. Finally, Mr. Swank from the courts.
Chair Williams, members of the House Judiciary Committee, for the record, my name is Brad Swank. I'm Special Counsel for Government Relations for the State Court Administrator's Office.
Have you lost your voice today, Brad?
Actually, it's been gone for about a week.
Oh, I didn't know that.
You've my written testimony in front of you. This is the third session in a row we've appeared in front of you in support of the basic concepts of this of what this bill is trying to do. This bill has six basic parts that I set out in my written testimony. We are very, very supportive of what we consider to be the primary parts of this bill, which are sections 1-4, which establish the task force to review and bring back to the legislature the information without which the conversation about what should happen to state courts cannot continue. We are very supportive of the third part of the bill, which are sections 6-10, and which provides procedure for the Department of Administrative Services to provide grants to counties to start improving state court facilities in the next biennium once you have the information about which courts need the most help and where you can start and what you can do. The information that the task force would develop would be essential to starting to provide money into the system. The other parts of the bill, one of them are what I call in my testimony Part 6, which are sections 16-19, is the $2 across the board increase in the unitary assessment to fund the part of the bill. The bill will need funds, whether it's or not it's best funded by an increase in the unitary assessment or by some other means. I think it's a policy decision for the legislature. There are discussions, as your chair knows, going on down in Ways and Means of other possible ways to tweak the same revenue stream to maybe develop revenue that in ways that wouldn't affect municipal or justice courts as much. That's your decision. There are two parts of the bill, and I've attached to the back of my testimony our thoughts on amendments that we talked to the counties about both in the fall and yesterday. We believe that Section 5 of the bill, which makes legislative findings about funding for state courts, is probably premature, and you shouldn't be making findings until you've had the report and recommendations presented to you. And we believe the fifth part of the bill, which are sections 12 and 13 and parts of other sections that refer to sections 12 or 13, which creates a current fund for the State Court Administrator's Office to pay for maintenance, is sort of borders on a political disaster because we wouldn't have any basis to start. First of all, we're not sure there's going to be any money in the fund. Secondly, we wouldn't have any basis to start paying for maintenance without the standards and some assessment anyway. So we think those should come out of the bill. In terms of the county's amendments, which we saw for the first time today, we talked about with the counties yesterday. We don't have any problem with anything except potentially the addition of a sheriff as a member. And sort of let me walk you through why that's an issue for us. As the chair knows, one of the meltdown points of this issue for years, for at least 6 years as far as I know, has been a large amount of political distrust about what's going to happen. Nobody really wants anybody else to be out of their sight because they're not sure what they're going to do. In this instance, Mr. Powell raises the issue of the importance of sheriffs because they're users. Mr. Dugan raises the importance of district attorneys. I got a call the other day from somebody about the importance of disabled people. All of those people are, in fact, important. The balancing act and a melting point over the years has been that no one user group wants any other user group to have a disproportionate number of votes on the task force. The way the bill is currently drafted, every user group has sort of a balanced number of votes. We would be perfectly supportive of having the task force bring in expertise, having there be non-voting members so that the vote counts don't get thrown off by people who are seen as being county representatives having more votes than people who are being seen as state representatives. We think those arguments, we think that can be done. Obviously, the district attorneys are an important user group. Obviously, the sheriffs and other police are important user groups. And their concerns need to be brought to the task force. We also think that because of the history of political distrust, there needs to be kept balance in the voting power on the task force. We also would like to thank Chair Williams. We know that there were a number of meetings on this. It's a really hard issue. People have been plowing this field for a long time, trying to get some advance on the conversation that needs to be taken. Every attorney who appears in a courthouse can tell you harrowing stories about the conditions of some courthouse that they've been in. There are problems. The conversation does need to be advanced. We're very supportive of it. It's a very difficult task that your chair took on. We're very appreciative that he did, and I can answer any questions that you've got.
Are there questions for Mr. Swain? Okay, thank you very much, Brad. Anyone further to testify on this bill? All right, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2073. I just encourage the folks who've been engaging in those discussions to engage in them a little bit further because the chair is done plowing and he's starting to plant, and something's going to grow very quickly. So with that, we are going to finish with a public hearing on House Bill 2115, and I appreciate the members staying. We want to bring up all three participants in this hearing, if I can, to move us as expeditiously as possible, knowing that you're not all on the same side. So, Mr. Fussner, again, District Attorney Dugan from Deschutes County, and Susan Russell from OOCDLA. If all three of you had come up, you're the only three that have signed up on the bill, and we'll try to move this as quickly as possible. Is there anybody else who'd signed up for the bill? Mr. Fussner, do you want to begin?
Chair Williams and members of the committee, I think I can very briefly explain to you the background of House Bill 2115. There are four instances in which a court can order a criminal defendant to be mentally examined. One is when the defendant gives notice of intent to file a mental disease or defect defense, which would operate as a complete defense to any crime. And if he does give that notice, then the state is entitled to have that defendant examined, and the statute says by a psychiatrist or a licensed psychologist. And the statutes I'm referring to are all set out in my written materials. Second instance is when a defendant intends to offer mental disease or defect evidence, not to support a complete defense, but to support what we call partial responsibility or diminished capacity defense, which means if the defendant is charged with an intent crime, where intent has to be proven, and he intends to introduce evidence that because of a mental disease or defect, he did not form the intent necessary for the crime. In such case, when a defendant gives notice, which he's required to do by statute, the state is then entitled to have a psychiatrist or licensed psychologist examine the defendant. Another instance is if a trial judge becomes aware that a defendant may not be competent to assist in his own defense and proceed to trial, the court is entitled to order him examined by a psychiatrist or licensed psychologist. And finally, this statute is not in my written testimony. I apologize for that. Under ORS 161.735, when a court has a convicted defendant before it who may qualify for an enhanced sentence as a dangerous offender, the court is authorized to order the defendant to be examined by a psychiatrist or licensed psychologist. You can see that the common theme here is all of these involve a psychiatrist or a licensed psychologist, except for one. The extreme emotional disturbance defense, or EED defense, which is raised when a defendant is charged with murder, and if the defendant can show that the murder was committed under the influence of an extreme emotional disturbance, the murder is reduced to a manslaughter in the first degree. That statute provides, again, that if the defendant gives notice of an EED defense, the state is entitled to have him examined, but only by a psychiatrist. The licensed psychologist was omitted from that statute. I can only assume that that was simply an oversight at some point, because given the presence of licensed psychologists everywhere else where this issue comes up, it's difficult to imagine that there was a reason why they would be omitted from the EED defense. So the purpose of this bill is simply to add licensed psychologists in for purposes of doing examinations for EED defense cases. Licensed psychologists pretty clearly are qualified to do that, and they often cost less money than psychiatrists. They are often more available to local communities, especially in eastern Oregon, than are psychiatrists, and they often can perform these examinations more quickly. And frankly, this bill came about because of a case that perhaps Mr. Dugan can elaborate on a little bit that's taking place, in fact being tried right now in Umatilla County, where the state had a heck of a time getting a psychiatrist to come in and evaluate the defendant. And basically for a small county, it was pretty difficult to afford what the psychiatrist wanted to charge. I might mention one final thing, and that is that the text of the bill contains a Section 3. Section 3, the purpose of that is to make it clear, I think, that where the statute already talks about partial responsibility and about the fact that a psychiatrist or psychologist can examine a person on a partial responsibility defense, that that also includes what we call diminished capacity. Those, I think, are synonyms, but some judges have said, well, It doesn't say diminished capacity in the statute, so I'm not going to allow an examination. That's the purpose of Section 3. With that, I am finished and be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Why don't we go ahead with you, District Attorney Gibbon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I want to second what Mr. Fussner has indicated to you and also point out, and I'd like to do this when I come to the legislature, is that this bill will absolutely cost the legislature zero amount of money. I think that's important to point out in these times. Most of the experts that are hired on behalf of the state are paid out of the district attorney witness fee or expert witness fee funds, and those funds are generally provided almost in total in my county by at least for expert witnesses, by the county budget. So it doesn't cost any money for the state. And it is true that to require us to be limited to a psychiatrist when somebody files the extreme emotional disturbance defense, where we are able to have psychologists or psychiatrists in any other type of mental disease defect, does put an added burden on some of us who live a little bit further away from Portland. In Deschutes County, we're fortunate. I think there are two psychiatrists there. But the further east you go, the fewer there are. And I believe currently there's being a case tried in Umatilla County, where Chris Brower, the district attorney there, was confronted with the extreme emotional disturbance defense, hired a psychologist. They then resulted in motions by the defense to prevent the psychologist from examining the defendant. They were granted by the court because the statute doesn't allow the psychologist to examine the defendant. Mr. Brower asked the Attorney General's office to file a writ of mandamus against the court to force the judge to order that they can do the psychologist. The Attorney General's office, of course, didn't do that because the statute is clearly against them. So what we are trying to do here is add the simple language of psychologists in that section to allow the state to make that choice. The defense has already made that choice. They've probably already had their client examined by one or more experts before they're going to give us the notice. Or if they give us a notice early and then have the examination determine that it's not a valid defense, they'll withdraw the notice. But nonetheless, we don't think it's going to cost any more money. It's going to save some money for the state and for the counties. In Chris Brower's case, the case got set over for a substantial period of time, delayed because they had trouble finding a psychiatrist that would come and do the examination. We support that bill, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I don't want to be the lawyer and say Your Honor, but I'll say that anyway. So I hope you can support it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Dugan. Why don't we hold the questions and allow Susan to go forward, and then we'll have a dialogue. Is that all right?
Sure. Susan Russell on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, and I'm here in opposition to Sections 2 and 3 of the House Bill 2115. We do not oppose Section 1, which would allow a licensed psychologist in addition to a psychiatrist conduct an evaluation in an extreme emotional disturbance defense. And I have to say, in terms of my comment, I feel confident in my analysis. I feel as though I'm testifying on a different bill with respect to the provisions of Section 2 and 3 because we strongly oppose these provisions and feel that they would be not only costly but would really sort of create a nightmare in terms of a procedure. In our opinion, House Bill 2115 unnecessarily amends the notice requirements to what's been referred to as a diminished capacity defense. It also gives the state an expansive right to have the defendant evaluated by an expert, even when the defense does not intend to use an expert. Maybe a little background might help to understand this. Under current law, where a defendant intends to offer expert testimony in his or her case in chief, the defendant must give notice. If the defendant does not intend to use an expert, there is no require for notice under what's been so-called a partial responsibility defense. And the reason is that when we call this sort of a defense, it's really not so much a defense. It's simply a principle that applies
that evidence of mental disease or defect is admissible whenever it's relevant to show that the actor did or did not have the intent to commit the crime. So evidence that negates an intent is always relevant, and the statute specifically provides that evidence of a mental disease or defect is admissible when it's relevant to show the defendant did or did not have intent. And the current law is that where the defendant intends to use an expert, the defendant must give the state notice, and the state has an opportunity to have the defendant evaluate, sort of an expert for expert. What House Bill 2115 would do would be to change that, to provide that the defendant may not introduce evidence on the issue of diminished capacity unless the defendant gives notice of intent to do so. So it would say it would expand the notice requirement to say if there's any evidence that the defendant intends to introduce or introduces at trial on the issue of diminished capacity, notice would have to be given before trial. And that would include where the testimony is limited to lay witnesses. There are a number of problems by doing this, and I don't think it's necessary. In fact, I haven't heard either the proponents of the bill even mention this issue. Let me go through those as quick as I can.
Well, let me stop and ask before we take everybody's time to go through the problem, and maybe Mr. Fussner or District Attorney Dugan would be willing to tell the committee, was it the intent by adding the Section 2 and 3 of the bill that is objectionable to OCDLA to try to get the same kind of notice for a lay witness evidence that might be related to an issue of capacity or might relate to capacity? Was it intended to capture that and require that notice be provided, or was it really intended to only block their ability to do that when it was going to be the expert kind of testimony that was going to come in that would allow you to go forward and get the analysis?
Chair Williams, I can respond to that unless Mr. Dugan sees it differently. This was originally a DOJ bill, and it was my understanding that there was no intention to expand the requirements for the notice the way Ms. Russell has described, and that really the only purpose was to make it clear that the requirement for notice of expert testimony that now exists in the statute for what they call partial responsibility applies equally well to what they call diminished capacity. But I don't think it was intended to expand it to non-expert testimony.
Is that your understanding?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that is also my understanding as well. There is really no such thing as a defense of partial responsibility. If the element is intentional conduct and you have a mental disease or defect that partially obliterates the intent element, that's a total defense. So when we're talking about partial responsibility, it's kind of a misnomer. So more often we're seeing the word diminished capacity, and we believe that it's necessary to get that cleared up.
Okay. So I guess what I want to, because it did, I mean, as I was looking at all of your testimony, it did look to me like I was reading about two different bills. It doesn't sound like we've got any disagreement about licensed psychologists being included in the list, which was the primary intent of the bill. And if it wasn't your intent to expand or change the current notice provision with respect to expert testimony, then that ought to alleviate your concerns, should it not, Susan?
And Mr. Chair, members, that's correct. I think that what all that's trying to be done is that they want to substitute the word diminished capacity for partial responsibility, and I agree diminished capacity is a more accurate term than partial responsibility, and I think they've inadvertently done things that would have been a horror for.
So here's what I'm going to suggest, to shortcut all of us just jawboning this more than we need to, because it sounds to me like there isn't really much of a disagreement between the three of you. If you guys can work out the language, get with Mr. Taylor on what the appropriate amendment would be. I think the committee would be, the remaining members, which doesn't constitute a quorum, would be happy to revisit the bill again and make the change. And if there isn't a real fight about what we're talking about, then let's just clean it up and get it done. Is that
satisfactory
to everyone?
We'll do that.
Okay. Thank you very much. We're going to close the hearing on House Bill 2115, and thanks, committee. Sorry we ran over. It's just one of those days. Let's adjourn the committee, and we'll take another crack at some of these later.